does God.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and today's episode feels a little bit like coming home. From the earliest days of the Deconstructionist Podcast, back when we were trying to figure out our voice, our mission, and frankly, our sound levels, Pete Rollins was one of the very first people who got it. Not just politely nodded along, but really understood from the outset exactly what it was we were trying to do. He's been a friend of the show since day one, and someone whose work helped shape the kind of conversations we wanted to bring into the world. It has been way too long since we've last had him on. This was long overdue, but trust me, the wait was worth it. Pete and I had one of the most energizing, thought-provoking conversations I've had in a really long time, the kind that sticks with you long after you stop recording. And I want you to pay special attention to his reflections on communion versus community. That section alone is a masterclass. It's challenging, it's refreshing, it's unexpected, and it might reframe the way you think about what church actually is. And good news, this is a two-parter, so settle in for part one today, and then come back for even more next week. So let's get into it. Here's my conversation with the always brilliant, always surprising, Peter freaking Rollins.
Is God even here? Does she care that I doubt? Does she care?
All right, it's been a long time coming and long overdue. Our dear friend and one of the early adopters and just somebody who from the very beginning kind of understood what the Deconstructionist was all about, what we were trying to do, and was gracious enough to come on in those early days before you really had any reason to come on, before we even really had an audience. So always, Adam and I have great love for you and welcome you back on. The good doctor, Peter Rollins. Thank you so much for coming back on.
Thank you. I appreciate it. As you know, whenever you started this, I was a big fan, big supporter. You guys were very kind to me. And so it's great to see that this has continued to go, it continued to develop and to grow. And it's lovely to be back.
Absolutely. And I thought, what better time? We are actually at the end of, within a couple months, we'll have hit 10 years since we first kicked this thing off, which is just mind-blowing.
Yeah. Wow, very good. I know it was going back a while because I remember when I was touring, I haven't toured for a long time. You guys showed up. Was it at Mars? Was it Grand Rapids? Was that right?
Yes. Yeah, you were doing Pints and Parables.
But that's probably going back, as you say, 10 years now. So, yeah.
It's been a little while. But yeah, Pints and Parables, we actually just re-released that one just because it's such a cool concept and was such a beautiful evening.
Oh, no way. Is that right? That's right. So you guys recorded that one. Oh, very good. Because for anybody who's listening who doesn't know, I used to, it would just be kind of storytelling in a pub. And I really love doing those events, I'll be honest. Would be quite excited about doing that again. It'd be quite fun.
You absolutely should. It was, I've never seen an audience, because you did such a good job of creating this sort of story arc and then taking people through just a range of emotions. I remember laughing. And then by the end, you had people in tears and it was just this beautiful event and a great opportunity to meet sort of other individuals who were into the same sort of things and just be able to have conversation afterwards. It was awesome. You should definitely do it again.
Yeah, thank you. Very good. Well, I'm going to do this podcast again. So I'm excited to dive in. Where do you want to go?
Yeah, so I think good place to start because it has been a number of years now and we've got some old school listeners who definitely will be excited to see your name pop up again. And we've got probably some new listeners who have more recently found the podcast. And so if you could, just a good place to start, talk a little bit about what you're known for, pyrotheology. And it's a very cool term, but what does that mean to you? How would you describe that to folks who are hearing it for the first time?
Yeah. I mean, that's a big task. We could be here all day talking about that, but yes, I'll try and sum up something, maybe try to, get an inroad to that answer by kind of maybe very quickly talking about where I started with my work and kind of how it's developed. I guess early in my work, I was interested in the place of doubt, ambiguity, and unknowing in life and in faith. The questions around the limits of our knowledge. Theology has always been interested in that. One of the kind of most theological definitions of God is God as a signifier is a signifier that signifies something beyond signification. So God is a word that we use to describe something indescribable. This is an idea in philosophy as well, but it's an interesting thing where theology has always been interested in tarrying with something that we do not know, something that draws us to the very limits of our experience and our understanding. So my work has always been interested in that. I have developed a theory and a practice that is very influenced by some areas of continental philosophy, some areas of psychoanalysis and radical theology, to develop a practice, a type of liturgy, a type of embodied experience. And that takes the form of three things. Very quickly, there is the liturgy, which I call transformance art, but that is a space where through music and art and storytelling, you enter into a space that transforms your way of being in the world. That's the idea, you know, of a liturgy. Decentering practices and what I call communion, a form of social bond, not forged around shared beliefs and identities, but on the shared realization that we are all lacking, that we all have doubt and unknowing as a part of our being. So yeah, so there's my work in a nutshell. There's a lot more to it, but you know, just as a little way in, I'll say that.
Yeah, and I love the idea of leaning into the unknowing or the mystery. I think because that is sort of one of the things that we seem to sort of push against or battle against, especially within Western Christianity, because it's so centered on knowing and certainty, and it creates sort of what we call this house of cards theology, where you know one thing. Point of that structure is sort of criticized and the whole thing collapses. And so I think a lot of folks who are in that sort of post-evangelical space, you know, have really sort of found a home in sort of mysticism and areas of theology that still allow you to sort of experience God and the divine, but not based on the condition that you have to understand or know everything. Mm-hmm. So I think even though, you know, I think your work and say like, you know, Richard Rohr's work are very different, I think the common thread there is the fact that there's this sort of, I guess, almost beauty in the unknowing, you know, and the fact that we do not have to have everything nailed down. In fact, we can't. It's impossible.
Yes. And this is a very important distinction. There's a difference between what's called epistemological unknowing and ontological unknowing. Definitely, people are very, you know, very influenced by the idea of epistemological unknowing, which is things we don't know because obviously we're limited. So there's things that I don't know that you know. There's things that other people know that we don't know. And then there's stuff that we don't currently know even as a species, but we will know in the future. And that notion of unknowing is uncontroversial. Everybody basically accepts it. But what I'm interested in is what can be called ontological unknowing. And that's a more radical claim. And that's a claim that unknowing is part of the very fabric of reality itself. And that actually we can know that we don't know. There's a certain sense in which it's not that we are protected from or we're unable to breach into the real, into the truth, but that actually part of the truth, part of the real, is precisely that there is novelty, there is spontaneity, there is a type of contradiction at the heart of everything. And so my work, you know, started off in that very uncontroversial epistemological unknowing, but has moved very much into this notion of ontological unknowing. And that's why, of course, I've got a big interest in psychoanalysis, because psychoanalysis is a discipline that in its proper form deals with something that is a type of structural absence called the unconscious. So anyway, that might differentiate me from people like Richard Rohr and others who will embrace epistemological unknowing, but they have an idea of a substantive absolute that knows everything. So we don't know everything, but you know, but the absolute knows everything. Whereas, you know, I'm more in the tradition of radical theology and German idealism, which is the idea that actually there is an unknowing in the very heart of absolute reality. Now, I have to show why I believe that. No one should believe me just because I'm saying it. So I'm kind of like showing my answers without my working out. So nobody should accept what I'm saying right now. But that's just a very brief way of describing the difference.
I love it. I love it. So talk about the Church of the Contradiction, because I think that's a big central part of your work as well. What does Church of the contradiction look like in practice? How much of it is metaphor? How much of it is institutional, organizational, and how much performative?
Yeah, so Church of the Contradiction is kind of the current name for the project that I'm working on. And it is a type of fundamentally different form of institution, which is not unusual. You know, the church goes through dramatic, what we call reformations. And those reformations are, interestingly, a reformation is not a change in signifiers, and I'll explain what I mean in a second. It's a change in signification. And what I mean by that is signifiers are, they include the words that we use, they're signifiers. And signified refers to the meaning of those. And in general life, we are interested in what people mean. So somebody makes a mistake, a Freudian slip or whatever, they say, I didn't mean that. And then we're interested, what did you really mean, right? But in psychoanalysis, you're interested in what the person said, not what they mean. And in a similar way, when a reformation happens, the signifiers don't actually change. So potentially crucifixion, resurrection, virgin birth, kenosis, you know, all of these theological terms, they all stay the same, but the signification radically changes. And so what keeps the Christian church in continuity with itself is not signification, but signifiers, a certain set of signifiers that are reimagined on occasions every, say, 500 years. So Church of the Contradiction is an approach, a theory and a technology that, I mean, in a nutshell, for anybody who's listening, you know, I'm in the same tradition as people like Slavoj Žižek. And, you know, what Slavoj Žižek has argued very beautifully many times is that, you know, in Christianity, in all religions, you have separation. You have some sort of separation from the appearance and the reality. The separation might be an illusion, right? Something you have to see through. We're caught up in the veil of illusions. Or it might be ontological. It might be a real rift within reality that has to be healed. But in all religions, you'll find here's where we are and here's where we should be. And religion provides a way of getting there, right? Or understanding why you're not there and getting there in the next life or after a few reincarnations, whatever. But in Christianity, you have the idea that it's not that we're separated from God, but that God is separated from God. So most obviously, we have it in the crucifixion. My God, why have you forsaken me? This is a really interesting innovation within religion where say, it's not that God experiences we experience separation from God, but here God is in kind of like in the narrative, is experiences self-division, right? God is divided. Now, this is kind of like a religious way of saying what we find in various modern sciences. So in evolution, the non-at-oneness of the biological organism is called evolution, right? So the non-at-oneness of the biological organism that creates complexity. In politics is called democracy, right? The non-at-oneness of the political body that generates civilization. In physics, you have got like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. You've got like where, you know, we have particle duality. You've got like an inherent kind of division within potentially the building blocks of physics. If you go with like the Copenhagen interpretation, which I do, you know, in the psychoanalysis, the non-at-oneness of consciousness with itself is called the unconscious, et cetera, et cetera. But the big name for this is Christ crucified, right? That's the death of God, right? It's because in Christ crucified, you have this idea of the self-divided absolute, which is a way of saying that reality is divided against itself. Now, if you take this seriously, understand, people don't need to take it seriously until they hear the argument, but if you take it seriously, this is a very different idea from what we commonly find. So one of the common ideas is we can be whole and complete by various things, right? Maybe it'll be taking psychedelics, right? Maybe it'll be commodity satisfaction if I have enough wealth and have enough commodities. It might be some sexual thing like polyamory or monogamy. It might be in like psychology, the idea of a balanced life and a fulfilled life, a happy life, right? Basically non-alienation and politics, a utopia, right? So you've got all these ways of trying to go like, we can overcome alienation. And in, for example, a lot of forms of therapy, there's a notion of a pre-traumatic subject. The pre-traumatic subject is traumatized. And then there's a post-traumatic subject, you know, where you can kind of get back, you know, which is, again, the religious idea of there's an original blessing, then there's a fall, and then there is a potential return to blessing, right? All that structure. This idea is very different because this idea says that alienation is inherent to being in itself and to being a subject. And therefore, the challenge is not to overcome alienation, but to embrace your alienation, to enjoy it, to say that I am alienated, that and not put it onto the other, which is called scapegoating, where I take my own lack, put it onto the other, put the violence onto them. It's more like AA, where you say my name and I am lacking, right? And sin to lack, you know, like it's not the moral connotation, but I am a lacker, I lack. And in embracing this experience of self-division, one can endure it and enjoy it. And Church of the Contradiction is about helping people confront this alienated absolute and help them become able to endure and enjoy their own alienation. And this changes your way of being in the world, because through this activity, you cease to be frenetically pursuing wholeness and happiness, certainty and satisfaction. And you can begin to enjoy your own alienation and become free, not free to pursue what will make you happy, but freedom from the pursuit of what will make you happy. Freedom to be miserable, freedom to be alone, freedom to, you know, to basically not be caught up in this frenetic pursuit of wholeness and happiness. And so that's Church of the Contradiction uses, as I say, it has a way of doing it, but we can get into it or not. But it ultimately helps people encounter that alienation.
Yeah, that's a perfect place to flow into this notion of communion versus community, which I think you make this great point. I was watching one of the debate that you did online recently between you and yourself, your AI self, which I thought was fascinating. If people haven't checked it out, I'll put the link in the show notes. You should definitely watch it. It's very fascinating. But talk about, you make this beautiful distinction between the two, because we always talk about in the podcast about how important community is, but you point out rightfully that to be a part of community is also inherently to place yourself in a position where there are folks who are outsiders. Or one of the common threads that binds you together is the fact that you have a shared enemy, which obviously is not something we want to do. And that's where, you know, communion, your definition of communion sort of comes into play. So talk about the distinction between those two.
Yeah. So basically, I've always had a certain difficulty with the word community. And if I can kind of sum that up in a nutshell, say, so community is a type of social bond. It's a particular type of social bond in which there are insiders and outsiders. And communities are forged around shared beliefs, shared values, shared practices, shared obstacles, and shared enemies. And the last two are particularly important, which you might come back to. But so you've got shared beliefs, shared values, shared identities, which creates a community. You'd all like football, or you all like a certain author, or whatever it is, right? We all have communities. It's very natural to have community. It is a particular type of social bond. But also communities have challenges. They always have something they want to overcome, whether it's, oh, we want to win the next general election or the next Super Bowl or whatever it is. There's an obstacle. And or there's enemies. These are the people who are preventing us from getting where we want to be. Another element of community to add to that is communities always have a sense of where you are and where you should be. So a community, by having obstacles and having enemies, you have a sense of, you know, we're here in terms of our political reality, but we want to be here in terms of the future or in any other sense. And the affect that's created by experiencing a disconnect between where you are and where you want to be is called guilt. So guilt is the affect that arises from you not being where you want to be. I'm talking about ontological. I'm not talking about like I'm guilty about this or that. More that there's that when you, and it doesn't matter if you're kind of think that you should be going out more, having more friends, you know, whatever it is, there's guilt. Guilt, as Lacan says, the superegoic injunction today is the injunction to enjoy, maximize the self, self-optimize, life hack, be all that you can be. And so we're guilty, not because we're not nice to our mum. We're guilty because we're not having enough fun, right? We're not enjoying enough, right? So the superegoic injunction makes us feel guilty, fear of missing out, et cetera, et cetera. So communities create this. That's community. And I say it's natural. We all have communities. Then the dialectical opposite of that is the commons. The commons are spaces where you meet people who are genuinely different from yourself. Like a public library is a commons, a park, public park is a commons. Again, a bus station is a commons. Commons is under threat today, but the commons is where you can encounter people who are genuinely different from you. Not just that you disagree with, but people who you disagree about what the disagreement is about. And that's very key. The problem is not disagreement. The problem in civilization is we disagree about how to interpret the disagreement itself. And that double knot creates incommensurable worlds. So that's the commons. The commons is not a social bond, but it's where you can meet somebody. But by the way, the commons is where love can happen. It's hard to have love in community because love, by definition, is an openness to the otherness of the other, right? When you just love the same people who you are, look like you, think like you, have the same identity, that's basically narcissism, right? It's a narcissistic thing. Real love arises when you encounter someone who is genuinely other from you, and they can be terrifying, but love occurs when you're able to provide a harbor for that otherness and vice versa, right? So that's why, Romeo and Juliet is a love story, because it's two completely different people, right? This is why love is hard to come by on dating apps, because people are thrown together with the same. You say, here's my political views, here's my religious views, and put me in touch with someone else who shares all of those, right? Whereas love happens in the commons, because you meet someone who you think's an asshole, you don't agree with them at all, and yet somehow you're like, something amazing's happening, right? That's where love can grow. Just to then the third space, which is what you mentioned, what I would call communion, and I don't mean it, I'm borrowing that word from religion. And there's a reason for that, which I can mention. But communion is a social bond that is forged not around shared beliefs, values, identities, obstacles, and enemies, but a bond that is forged around the fact that we are all lacking beings, that we're all, in a sense, traumatized beings in that sense, the trauma of being human, that lack, unknowing, doubt are an inherent part of our being. And so, in a way, right, you've got on the right, you have these ideas of universal positive values. So the right talks about equality under the law, talks about things like meritocracy and all of that, right? Facts don't care about your feelings, whatever. And that's because they're universal positives, positive things that we all share in common as humanity, right? Then on the liberal left, you have a critique of that. And the critique in a nutshell is that all supposed universal identities are crypto-particularistic. In other words, they actually help some groups over others, right? What looks like a universal characteristic really is a benefit to one group over others. And so the critique means we're all caught up in our own identities and we create smaller communities that intersect with each other, right? That's the liberal left critique. This is the critique of that, which is to say that, no, we do have a universal that we all share in common, but it's not something positive. It's a negative. It's a negation. What we all share in common is the death of God. This is why I call it communion, is a fundamental gaping void that is part of the very fabric of subjectivity and of reality itself. So that's what communion is, a social bond. And by the way, an example of a communion is AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. You have different people with different values and different political views and completely different. They come together because they have a shared defense over not shared traumas. Like various traumas happen in AA, but what brings them together is they have a shared defense against their trauma, and that's, drinking, right? In AA, it's about acknowledging in a space of grace. You just say your name and say you're an alcoholic where nobody tries to change you. So grace is where you accept that you're accepted. It's the opposite of self-help, where self-help tells you how to go from A to B, which is part of community, how to go from A to B. In grace, there's no going from A to B. You just admit where you are. You admit you're at A with no need to change. You realize that A does not equal A, which means you're self-divided and you're full of conflicts, but you stay in a place of grace, what you can call step zero. And then through that experience of grace, you can experience forgiveness, right? So what is forgiveness? Well, very simply, forgiveness is freedom from guilt and condemnation. So if guilt is the affect that you get from moving from A to B, then forgiveness is the experience of not having to move from A to B, of pure acceptance for who you are, right? So in AA, you get that pure acceptance, no moving from A to B, no guilt. You're freed from guilt. You experience forgiveness, which ironically allows you to change. One final thing I'll say about the difference between community and communion is communities, the ideal of community is the hero, because the hero is someone who is able to get from A to B, right? Who's able to engage their will and try to move forward. So that's the kind of figure of community. The ideal figure of communion is the saint. The saint is someone who doesn't get somewhere through will, but through contemplation, through giving up, through experiencing forgiveness and grace. That's the power that moves the saint, not the hero, which is going from A to B. So anyway, there you go. In brief, that's, and I'm trying to, for me, communion is a vital form of social bond that we need. Otherwise, civilization falls apart.
And I remember the first time hearing you say that, I thought, what a brilliant way to sort of use a religious archetype, you know, in the sense that when I think of ways in which to get people together, you know, may come from very differing viewpoints, or whether it be social, political, whatever, sitting down and having a meal, which is literally the definition of the religious act of communion. We're all going to have this meal together, and guaranteed that the person on my left and right probably have very different ideas than I do on a number of issues. But we're there for that shared common meal. And that's, you know, as opposed to, as you said, you know, joining a community where oftentimes it's a club because you all believe and think the same thing. You're coming together, you know, through this act of forgiveness by way of meal.
Yes.
That's such a powerful, powerful visual thing, and also act that's taking place, you know, amongst people who are very, very different from you.
Yes. And the very key, the key bit for me is the meal's important. And I call these the Death of God supper clubs because they're a little bit of food. But the key is that you're gathered together, not simply around a meal, but around a shared loss. So communion is a meal around the death of God, the loss of the absolute. And so in a way, in these communions, what joins me to you is that by dint of being human, there has been a loss. I mean, you know, at a very superficial level, like, you know, basic kind of like popular view of Freud, Freud's a bit more complicated, but popular view of Freud is, you know, the mother and child are like a symbiotic union, and then the infant separates from the mother. And in that separation, they become a subject. So subjectivity is marked fundamentally by a loss. That's why within psychoanalysis, there's no pre-traumatic subject, because in a sense, trauma is part of the very coming into being of subjectivity, separation, loss, etc. And so the death of God, which by the way, we have the circled around a big void in the middle, is to say that, oh yeah, what unifies us all is in different ways, no matter how good your life has been or whatever, is that we are all marked by a fundamental enigmatic dimension.
Have a faith. Does he have a body or even a name? If he does he know that I'm alive? Is God even here? Does she care that I doubt? Does she care? A face. Her face must look like yours. A face like a Tina, an Ahmed or Mildred, a Russ and his husband, Gus and their children. Face like a Kim, a Ted or Tyrone, a Lucy born with an extra chromosome, a Pablo with legs he can't move by himself, a girl born a Daniel who now is Danielle, a Bill agent, even white guys named Todd. If you have a heartbeat, you are the face.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.